Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the education channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tom DeSena, from the Department of Communication, Journalism, and Public Relations at Oakland University. My guest today is Joshua Price, the author of Just Work for All, The American Dream in the 21st Century. Just Work for All is a book about the American dream, how to understand the central principle of American public philosophy, the ways in which it is threatened by a number of winner-take-all economic trends, and how to make it a reality for workers and their families in the 21st century. Integrating political philosophy and the history of political thought with recent work in economics, political science, and sociology, this book calls for renewed political and policy commitment to just work. My guest today is Joshua Price, is a professor of philosophy and director of philosophy, politics, and economics at Minnesota State University, Mankato. His research is in social and political philosophy, political economy, applied ethics, and the philosophy of economics. His work can be found in such journals as European Journal of Political Theory, Philosophy and Social Criticism, Social Theory and Practice, Basic Income Studies, and Critical Review of International Social and Political Philosophy. For the academic year 2016-2017, Price was an associate professor of political theory at Brown University and is on the editorial board of Business Ethics Quarterly. Joshua Price, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks, Tom. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So you begin Just Work for All with the economic consequences of the pandemic, which at the time of publication had really just begun. And you used the economic contraction caused by COVID to highlight the degree to which our contemporary circumstances fall short of not just the American dream, but even for some of the hopes that people once had for the future of work. So I want to start our conversation today with the Jetsons. What does this seemingly innocuous television show from the early 60s have to tell us about work in the 21st century?
Well, in some ways, not that much, as I argue, but I make this distinction, but I have this title, which I'm sort of pleased with, being someone who watched way too much television as a young child, and that meant Jetsons episodes. I have this, as you know, the section in the intro on called The Jetsons and James Meade. And I contrast the work of James Meade on, you know, sort of his worries, his predictions about how, you know, wealthier societies are going to continue to develop as they continue to adopt, automation or labor replacing technologies. And what happens, and of course, he hasn't read the contemporary economists like Dorone Simoglu and others that I talk about in the book, but this sort of wondering whether or not the economy will reinstate displaced labor, and if they do, how they'll be reinstated? Will they continue to command a share of the fruits of economic growth, or will they? In his view, his worry, I should say, he's generally optimistic, but his worry is without adapting public policy, what's going to happen is you're going to get a relatively small collection of really wealthy capital owners, and a lot of the sort of middle class labor of the mid 20th century employment will get displaced and get moved to sort of low productivity, low wage, service sector, right? The Jetsons, by contrast, has a different vision of the future. It's a vision of the future where the fruits of economic growth are more or less equally shared, right? So you have George Jetson, a kind of a working class stiff in the show, right? It's very clear that he's not an executive. He's not one of the he's not in the commanding heights of the economy. He's he drives his compact saucer to and from work. He's always worried about his little domestic appliances. Him and Jane are worried about their domestic appliances breaking down. So they don't have a ton of wealth, right? But actually, they don't work very much. Their future looks a little bit like the most positive sort of story that like someone like Keynes, John Maynard Keynes would say, which is, you know, as automation continues, is technology keeps making these basic tasks obsolete, what we're going to get, what might happen, and of course Keynes is worried about things that might happen to prevent this from going this way too, is what you'll get is lots more leisure time. You'll get someone that's, whose schedule looks a lot more like George and Jane Jetson's. They put in a couple hours of work a week, day, and they have a broadly secure, I mean, he's always worried that Mr. Spacely will hire them, but you don't really get, fire him, but you don't really get any sense that if he was fired, that he wouldn't be able to find a similar employment. So you get, in other words, you get sort of an extrapolation of what in many ways was the lived experience of people at the time when the Jetsons was being produced and distributed, which is that you had several decades of broad-based, inclusive economic growth. Right? You didn't have an egalitarian society in the sense that people were equally wealthy or powerful, far from it. But nonetheless, people up and down sort of the wealth and income ladders saw comparable increases in their standard of living. And as a result, people up and down these ladders were able to translate, if you will, productivity gains into more stuff, you know, better quality of life, higher life expectancy, and more leisure time, right? And so in a way, the Jetsons is a vision of the future where technological change keeps pushing us in that direction, the direction where we do less and less and less and less work because the machines do it for us. But nonetheless, the gains from that growth are more or less egalitarian in the sense that they're widely shared, right? So that's sort of the vision of the future. There's all sorts of problems with that vision of the future, as I talk about in chapter 4 and 5 in particular. It's that the Jetsons is not a model of an ideally just society or anything like that. But one thing that is sort of like positive about it is, again, that this widely shared growth leads to comparable gains. And that means we all sort of like, you know, again, translate our work into a middle-class life, and we have to work less as a result of technological advancement.
So in the first chapter, you draw a distinction between what you call a Smithian well-ordered society and our current condition of a winner-take-all society. Can you describe what you mean by these two terms and the consequences for seemingly having adopted one version over the other?
Yeah, good question. Yeah. So the distinction between a Smithian well-ordered society and a winner-take-all society, you know, as I put it in the book, you know, we're transitioning, we in the American context, but solely not in the American text, we're looking less and less like the Smithian well-ordered society, which is not to say that we ever were a perfectly Smithian well-ordered society, or even that a Smithian well-ordered society is the ideal of justice. Like it's a complete ideal of justice that encompasses everything we care about. But one thing the Smithian well-ordered society does capture is this idea that, you know, and again, fundamental in Adam Smith's arguments for the adoption of market institutions and the reform and the rejection of mercantilist and feudalist institutions, the reason why markets are to be favored. One sort of aspect of this Smithian well-ordered society is it's a society with rapid economic growth. Now, just work, as I talk about it, for that principle to be put into practice, it doesn't depend upon rapid economic growth. But a Smithian well-ordered society is a rapid, rapidly growing society, economy that becomes increasingly more productive, right? But the sort of moral core of Smith is not, great gains to growth or productivity in a distributive, insensitive sort of way. Central to Smith and really most sort of philosophers who are sort of, you know, sort of the historical genesis of what came to be known as the modern discipline of economics, right? Smith is often thought of as the founding father of the discipline of economics. The central sort of like the normative core here for Smith is the elevation of the working poor, right? So a Smithian welfare society is a society where people who possess and act according to market-specific virtues, people who are willing to work hard, people who are prudent, people who are creative, innovative, these people will see their labor, as he puts it, liberally rewarded, right? So a Smithian welfare society can be a society that has a lot of economic inequality per se, but it's one in a society where economic inequality doesn't get to the levels where it where he is concerned it will corrupt these sort of the virtues that make markets function well, right? But it's also a society where the gains to economic growth are more or less equitable, in the sense that you might, you know, to use a particular way of it, a rising tide is effectively lifting all boats. Right. So that's a Smithian welfare society. In mid-century United States, you know, and I talk about, you know, I use this idea of a Smithian welfare society to capture a wide range of work in political economy, economics, economic history, to capture a number of different trends. And there's a lot of disputes as to, you know, what's the primary sources, you know, is it primary labor displacement that's going on? Is it primarily worker decline in bargaining power and union power? I don't particularly enter into that debate, or rather I should say a Smithian Weller society could say, okay, whatever the reasons, start from there. Anyway. We're going from a society that does not, again, follow this pattern of the Jetsons. Right, where you know, we don't have this, where the gains are more or less widely shared, and you know, again, and not only that, but where workers can expect a better life for themselves in general, right? You have in the people born in the 1940s, for example, you know, recent work by economists Raj Chetty and others, you know, had, you know, absolute mobility, the ability to do better off than your parents were at a comparable age, you know, peaked at 90%, and right now it's at or below 50%, depending on how you read the data, right? So this is a society where honest, good, you know, hard work was well rewarded, right? And a winner-take-all society, by contrast, right, or the winner-take-all trends I describe are trends in political economy, you know, and again, I say political economy because I'm not dissociating the politics from the economics of it. Right, these trends are found in a wide range of different places with very different political histories. Right, so they are, you know, in a sense, sort of trends that a lot of different countries are dealing with. Right, but the extent to which they are dealing with them and the way they are characterized is due a lot in terms of the political decisions that these countries are made. So these trends in political economy instead are creating a society where the fruits of economic growth are increasingly. You know, you might say captured or go to, are claimed by, are reserved by, increasingly small. The reason why I don't say captured is because it need not necessarily have a nefarious explanation, right? Winner take all markets can sometimes just reward people who are particularly excellent, right? But the nature of these winner take all markets, right? And again, and, you know, I talk about, you know, a variety of trends from labor polarization to the winner or take all our superstar markets in a kind of more technical sense. But in these markets, you know, small differences in luck, small differences in skill, small differences in effort, small differences in connection, who got there first, can make a massive difference in people's reward. So instead of getting a society for people who are willing to work hard can, you know, claim a share of the fruits of economic growth, you increasingly get a society where much of that economic growth is again captured by the top, and you get a kind of hollowing out of the middle class. Right, exactly. And in combination with the hollowing out of the middle class, you get I talk about security as well. So you get sort of you get this sort of widespread, pervasive sense and real sense of security, where people are living paycheck to paycheck, and so on. And so that's this, you know, in a kind of like a, in brief, that's the transition here, right? You're getting this, and you know, lots of different data to talk about, but these two sort of frames are a way of sort of, I don't know, ideal types that then enable me in the rest of the text to think through what the implications for these are, according to how we ought to think about justice, which, you know, which principles of justice are most compelling, most important in this context, and also what the if you will, the sort of normative crisis in contemporary political economy is. So that becomes sort of the background for that discussion.
Yeah. And that leads us to the second chapter. And here you describe the something you call the American public philosophy of markets. And I'd like you to explain to our listeners what is included in this public philosophy of markets, and perhaps even more importantly, what doesn't seem to be a part of the American public's belief system in regards to how markets are supposed to function.
Yeah. And if it's okay, I might actually take kind of a second to talk about the methodology. You know, you say it's an American public philosophy of markets. You know, part of what goes on in chapter two, and I talk about it in chapter six and elsewhere in the book too, is, you know, I have a particular sort of meaning or vision for what I'm trying to accomplish as a public philosophy. And the reason why I'm going to sort of talk a bit methodologically about that is in part because then it informs my use of engagement with the political science and sociology of American beliefs and why it's so important. So there might be a kind of way of thinking about what we should be doing here is to say, like, look, it doesn't particularly matter what most people believe. Most people may believe all sorts of really erroneous or conflicting things. You know, one should present a vision of justice that everyone should believe, right? Whereas mine, to use the language that a philosopher might use, my account's internal or internalist in a certain sense, right? I work through my idea of public philosophy is to kind of work through the views that I find, right? To take the state of the art of people's conceptions of what matters with respect to economic justice broadly conceived, and to challenge those to a certain extent and to see what they work out, but to meet my sort of fellow citizens where they are. And there's a number of reasons why I do that, in the book, but I can, you know, we can talk a little bit less about that perhaps right now and sort of move on to what this American public philosophy of markets is, right? So doing public philosophy, you know, part of what makes it public in my sense is that it's rooted in widely shared beliefs and concerns. And with respect to the public philosophy of markets in the contemporary United States, I address, I guess you might say, two ways of thinking about it that I don't think are particularly accurately reflected in the way, two ways that sometimes people characterize American public philosophy of markets. One, that we're primarily or exclusively concerned with something like a fair equality of opportunity or what I call fair rights. You know, that is this idea that, you know, justice just is, kind of like something like a level starting playing field, kind of like an equal starting gate. And Americans, unlike sometimes this is the character, right? Caricature. Americans, unlike maybe some people in continental Europe, are less concerned with inequality per se and more concerned with inequality of opportunity, understood again in this fair race sense of the term. Another is that Americans don't really care about inequality. In part because they have a kind of Leslie McCall calls this kind of, you know, she calls it when she's characterizing it. She doesn't think this is a primary American belief. This bootstraps idea, that we should be able to pull ourselves by our own bootstraps. So a lot of way of talking about American beliefs about inequality is based on scholarship and readings and survey data from a broadly Smithian well-ordered society context, right? So you get a context in the 50s, 60s, and 70s and into the early 80s where people experienced and more or less believed that equitable growth was kind of how markets worked. And so in this context, it's natural that they would be more inclined to be convinced by either sort of fair equality of opportunity, sort of a meritocratic value, or again, this bootstraps value, because their reality is such that that's what they were seeing. Like if someone was in this context of SWO, ideally speaking, in that ideal as example, someone is able to translate hard work into a better life for themselves. So if you look at their beliefs in this situation, that's what you're going to see. But in fact, Americans do care about inequality, but they care about it not necessarily in a way that is always captured well by analytic political philosophers, even when they're talking about even when they're claiming to present a view that captures widespread values. In particular, you know, the Americans aren't so concerned with is a luck egalitarian. So luck egalitarian in the language of political philosophy is a term that Elizabeth Anderson used, and she in a critical work to characterize a wide range of theorists who held different beliefs about justice, but this basic idea that a just society is one where people get what they deserve, meaning what they're responsible for. So Americans recognize, by and large, that inequalities might not reflect effort and merit, right? They're not concerned that inequalities inequalities that are the product of unequal talent, right? So they're not seeking this neutralization of everything that people are not responsible for. What they're most concerned about, what I remain convinced that is essential, compelling, is these inequalities become a problem when you go further and further from something like a Smithian well-ordered society. That is when insofar as people at the top are able to distance themselves from the rest of society in a way such that they're getting the fruits of growth, whereas other people are not. Or insofar as in times of crisis, they're able to isolate themselves and they profit while everyone else suffers. That's when Americans get particularly upset about inequality. That is, they see it as a kind of violation of how market societies are supposed to work. That is, insofar as a rising tide is lifting all boats, you know, that CEOs make more if it's not completely distant is not a particular concern,
right?
Because
it's
they can be seen as good shepherds of economic growth, if you will, right? They take on this responsibility. They're better suited for these towns. They make more, fine. That's fine, right? But insofar as that those group of people are able to separate themselves, insofar as they're able to profit even when others are getting increasingly less secure and stagnating, that's when they tend to be particularly concerned, right? And so that doesn't particularly capture, you know, either a luck egalitarian reading of American political culture or a libertarian reading of political culture, which, says something like, hey, look, you know, the job of society, you know, libertarian political philosophy can sometimes seem to capture widespread views in American public philosophy of markets, in part because Americans in general have this widespread skepticism of the use of government power built in there, right? And so it can seem like that, but in fact, no, they hold something very different than that as well.
Can you describe that a little bit more, just the idea of the libertarian streak?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So when I discuss libertarianism in the book and in a couple earlier papers, I look at it through the lens of personal responsibility. So, and I look at a set of libertarian theorists, particularly I look at David Schmitz. You could call them libertarian, you call them classical liberal, F.A. Hayek, and then of course Robert Nozick. Right, all of these people wrote very sophisticated works in political philosophy. All of these people, had insights. But their work, one broad sort of overlap in their work in this context is a certain sort of insensitivity to forms of distributive or opportunity injustice, right? And I argue like and what's the problem with like that? Well, as a standalone system, I don't argue per se against what either of these theorists propose, kind of in abstraction, right? But in the context of American public philosophy that has this broadly Smithian understanding of how markets can and should work, you can get a lot of disastrous consequences by passing public policy in libertarian terms. And part of the reason why this can happen is because there might appear to be a natural overlap, and indeed sort of this was often called by Buckley and other sort of thinkers as a kind of conservative libertarian fusionism, right? There might appear to be a kind of political and philosophical overlap between meritocratic conservatives, right? You know, who say like, look, you know, who are objecting to welfare state or social democratic policies because they're taking from people who deserve something and giving it to people who haven't, either because they're unwilling to work or whatever, right? So now libertarian thought gives us all sorts of reasons to question this meritocratic conservative, right? And in fact, Hayek is going to say, you know, basically that's just false to think that that's how markets work. Markets don't track merit in that sense of the word, in that normative sense. And then Schmitz himself is going to redefine merit in a way that's sort of opportunity insensitive, is in the book, as I describe in the book. So the fusionism, it's not an actual philosophical overlap, but they might still recommend the same principles because the conservatives believe wrongly that they further merit in these sort of ways. But then the libertarians also affirm them because they're not concerned with merit in these sorts of ways at all. And the problem from a libertarian public philosophy then is dealing with the negative externalities of this affirmation. Right. In a context where people hold the sort of political moral views that look more like Smith's and less like Hayek's, right? That is where they generally tend to think that markets reward virtue and that people who fail to do well in markets do so because they lack a certain set of virtues, right? Hayek can tell us all sorts of reasons why markets aren't meant to capture virtue in that way. But if most citizens believe that markets capture virtue in that way,
they do.
Then not policies that hold them accountable to their actions.
Right.
All sorts of people who are not unvirtuous are going to be judged as unvirtuous, right? That's going to condition all sorts of things that the libertarian would think is terrible, like, you know, the extreme examples, forcing people to pee in their cup to get welfare benefits, or, you know, back in the day, to have people show up at single mothers' houses and make sure that they weren't illicitly having affairs in front of their children, and all sorts of other things that a libertarian can, any thoughtful libertarian, you have this distinction between like libertarian political philosophy proper and people who might call themselves libertarians in the American public sphere, but don't really hold much of anything like a libertarian public philosophy. Totally fine with locking up, immigrants, for example, or whatever.
Yeah.
Something, you know, a libertarian is going to be a pro open borders. So there's all sorts of but
the politician
the politician might very much not be, even though they call themselves a libertarian. Anyway, that issue aside, the negative externalities of having this political of applying preferred libertarian policies in a political culture where people don't believe anything like a libertarian reality about what how markets work can be really problematic for those reasons, but it also can fail to address all the other sort of negative externalities of a winner-take-all society, and among others, you know, just to kind of, you know, without going through a laundry list of the stuff I talk about it, among others, this, you know, rapid rise in what, you know, Ann Case and Angus Deaton called deaths of despair, right? These people living in communities of prolonged, you know, lack of economic opportunity, such that, you know, declining hope for themselves or for their children, and which Case and Deaton link to rising suicide and rising use of drugs. And Case and Deaton here are sort of like this is often, you know, happening more and more in, you know, rural or, you know, suburban, formerly suburban, you know, think Dayton, Ohio, or different parts of the Rust Belt United States, sure. Right? It's happening increasingly to white Americans, but of course a similar phenomenon could, you know, William Julius Wilson, just a generation earlier, right? You know, is work, you know, like, so, you know, Wilson has this great, you know, sort of series of works on what happens when work disappears, right? And a lot of the African-American populations in particular, I mean, populations in general, but disproportionately representing an African-American workers, you know, people who, you know, migrated to the North for industrial jobs, what happens when these middle-class jobs leave, right? You get the same sort of thing, right? And in fact, much of what you're seeing in this, you know, Case and Deaton talk about, you know, you actually had, and of course, since COVID, we've actually had another couple years of declining life expectancy. But even pre-COVID, you had something which was really almost unheard of in a wealthy developed country like the United States, which is actually declining life expectancy. And this was almost exclusively the product of these rising deaths of despair among middle-aged white communities. But you had the same phenomenon hitting African-American communities a generation earlier, although one notable difference is that African-Americans don't really commit suicide in the same way that white Americans were. But there were, you know, you had these similar things happen, right? You need opportunity and distributive sensitive public philosophy to fully address that. I mean, I think a certain sort of libertarian might just say, no, you just get a perfectly competitive market. You get actually Smith's sort of neoclassical vision, right, and you won't have to worry about it. Right. One that doesn't,
everything will just fall into place.
Yeah. Right. And even if you believe that's true though, of course, that's not the way, political economy works. That's not the way the theory and practice of justice works. You don't just get to stipulate your ideal. You have to stipulate incremental changes. You have to stipulate political, you have to talk about political, whatever. And libertarians have, you know, there's lots of really smart libertarian thinkers out here talk about these things, but nonetheless, for those reasons I just argued, this philosophy is just really poorly suited to an increasingly winner take all society. You know, and so if nothing else, libertarians need to address, you know, I say rule number one for a libertarian public philosophy is to sort of pound on the table and say, no, poor people aren't poor because they deserve it. Wealthy people aren't wealthy because they deserve it, right? It has nothing to do with desert or very little to do with what they deserve in any normative sense. Now, most libertarians won't do that, I argue, or I worry. For a variety of reasons. One reason is they might be concerned that, hey, if you start undermining this myth of meritocracy, you might invite all sorts of left-wing politics that we don't want, right? So, you know, you got to keep the barbarians at the gate, as it were, of the people who are already looking for ways to upset markets, and you got to keep them at bay. And one way to keep them at bay, and one way to motivate them, Hayek believes, is it's fine if they believe something largely false, which is how well off they do as a result of their efforts. But if they believe their efforts make them better off, then they're likely to work harder, and that'll be better for everybody, right? A kind of false ideology, if you will. And I talk about the problems with that anyway. That's probably enough on that particular that topic, but that's the issue. I think we got in there pretty good. So,
yes, we did. So let's talk for a minute. You've already brought up the idea of the fair race, and I want to talk about it in relation to sort of the central feature of your book, which is this idea of the American dream. And obviously there's a lot that can be sort of folded into the idea of the American dream. You focus on two ideas, as we mentioned before, fair race and just work. Talk a little bit about both of these and the relationship to the standard of the American dream.
Good. Okay. So the fair race conception, again, just to sort of rehearse it very quickly, a fair race conception is, broadly speaking, a level playing field, right? And so I have this kind of, I give this, one of the epigraphs in chapter three, I actually have a Paul Ryan epigraph. So he says, what is it? And he made this sort of argument is, he wanted to paint Barack Obama as a equality of result person rather than equality of opportunity person. And he said, so he, you know, he wrote, justice is done when we level the playing field at the starting line, and rewards are proportionate to effort and merit. And whereas others might say, your career open to your talents or to best fully realize your talents. So one half of, you know, James Truslow Adams famously coined this concept of the American dream, right? One half of this is that we'll be able to achieve the most we can with our talents. So one sort of widely held part of the American dream as a public philosophy, and sometimes the American dream in certain discourses just gets reduced to this, is this idea that, you know, hey, look, unlike these, you know, these sort of old, wealthy, sort of hierarchical societies. The United States, America is a country where you can make it if you try. And make it if you try means that, you know, everybody has a more or less fair shot at getting what they want, positions of privilege, positions of, you know, a good life for themselves and their family and so on, right? And so the problem from a justice perspective then is all the sorts of inequalities of opportunities that can undermine this fair competition, right? Another idea that also is found in the American dream, right? I talk about the American dream as a kind of organizing concept for a lot of different principles of justice. Another central conception is this idea of just work. And a just work principle says, you know, reflects the dignity. It's a principle that's more concerned with the dignity of work and the people who perform it, right? So the principle of just work then, you know, is one where individuals, you know, it's not reducible to the idea of a Smithian well-ordered society, but it's a kind of relational principle in the sense that a just work society is one where workers' welfare and status is, if you will, befitting the contributions they make, not in a marginal productivity sense, but in a way that respects sort of the fund is Martin Luther King would put it, the fundamental dignity of work, right? So So in a growing society, this would mean that people who are willing to work hard will gain a share of the fruits of economic growth. You know, in a stagnant society, that they, you know, that they will be able to, in some broad sense, relate to their fellow citizens as free and equal. So, right. So lurking in this idea of just work is this sort of fundamental belief in American public philosophy of markets, which is that people should be able to exchange hard work for, broadly speaking, a middle class life. And a middle class life is one with a context relative, you know, the way you think about it is a context relative set of wages, but it also concerns status and security. And Americans are also historically, like literally from day one, concerned with domination, right? So there's this longstanding trend in American public philosophy, sometimes gets in contemporary political theory, gets put it into either relational egalitarian views or neo-Republican conceptions, right? Where, you know, we should be able to relate to our fellow citizens in free and equal. And this means that we are not, in some sense, subject to their dominating power over us. So, right. So the idea of just work captures this, that concern as well, that that a just work society is one where workers are not, you know, they have to follow orders in the workplace in order to get the job done, right, in a hierarchical structure. But there's a way in which they can still relate to even their employers, even their managers, as free and equal persons, right? So that's the core understanding of just work. It's not, how best to put it, it's unlike fair race, it's distribution sensitive in a way that fair race is not, right? It's so you have to fundamentally ask, not only was the game fair, but what are the results of the game insofar as a game is a good way of thinking about it. So that's the distinction that's going there.
So, and you mentioned in that discussion, Dr. King, which brings us to the fourth chapter of your book, where you bring up the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about, you know, people sometimes forget how important economic justice was to Dr. King.
Right. Well, let me kind of fold one of the things I talk about in at the end of chapter three, together with King here, because you might say, you know, I say this is a work of public philosophy. You know, in a way, Martin Luther King is sort of the most prominent, most influential public philosopher. That I address in the sense, in a way, you might say he's the most influential public philosopher in the United States. But sometimes when people think about him, you get the certain segments of the "I Have a Dream" speech taken in isolation from his broader concern with the dignity of work. But let's talk for a second about this distinction between fair race and just work, and then we'll replay it through King's conception of the ends of the civil rights movement. So one of the central things I argue in the text is that while both just work and fair race are core constituents of American public philosophy and our conception of the American dream, they take on different levels of import in different contexts, right? So in a broadly Smithian, well-ordered society, you know, much of what people are concerned with in the principle of just work are largely met by the structure of that political economy itself, right? Generally speaking, people who are willing to work hard can expect a better life for themselves. You know, as Barack Obama puts it, America is the place where hard work is a ticket to the middle class, and you can make it if you try, right? The middle class, again, being this context sensitive understanding of wages and benefits and status and so on, right? So in the context of Smithian world, but that still might be a society like mid-century United States society that was radically unjust from the perspective of fair race, right? Where all sorts of people had far greater opportunity and lots of people were very much shut out of, you know, reaching higher is a, not in an intrinsic sense, but there are lots of opportunities that were closed off, right? On the basis of race and gender, but class as well. But in the context of Smithian well-ordered society, where just work is more easily realizable in the nature of the institutions, it makes sense for our public philosophy to start keep poking on, to keep trying to address those concerned with justice, those concerned with the American dream, to engage with, to try and address obstacles to fair race and to level the playing field. But in a context of a winner-take-all society, you know, in a winner-take-all society, even if you level the playing field, you're going to still end up with a context in which large segments of the population are just simply left behind. In the context of a winner-take-all society, even if everybody gets a fair shot, narrow differences in talent and effort and networks are going to lead to all sorts of issues with just work, right? So in that context, in our current context, we have a lot more reason to give priority to this idea of just work. And not only that, but when we connect the, if you will, the philosophy and the economics to the politics, right? Even if you think that a just society is one where everybody gets a fair shot, in a winner-take-all society, the economics of a winner-take-all society is going to keep undermining fair race, right? People who win are going to win a lot, and they're going to use that winnings to close off opportunities, to give their children opportunities that other people don't, right? Whereas in a Smithian well-ordered society or something that approaches that, when the fruits of gain are more widely shared, right, people have less incentive to opportunity hoard, as it sometimes said. Okay. So with that sort of focusing on just work inside, I argue then in turn that way of thinking about King's ends of the civil rights movement, but also one of the central challenges for racial justice in the United States should be thought of in terms of just work, right? And this is not to deny that issues of fair race are important. You know, I raised this distinction that Nancy Fraser talks about between this paradigm of recognition and this paradigm of redistribution, right? And so in no way do I or King deny that recognition is really important. In fact, it's crucial. You know, I have lots of quotes from King in the book regarding just how important it is to status and so on and so forth, right? But one problem we might face is if we reduce is if we only focus on recognition, or if we treat redistribution, issues of redistribution, is fundamentally the product of misrecognition or malrecognition. Because a big part of what's going on in contemporary political economy is that African-American gains in terms of educational fulfillment and opportunity, in terms of status recognition, right, are being swamped in many cases by winner-take-all trends. And this is precisely what King was concerned with, right? The second sort of stage of the civil rights movement, as he thought about it, a stage which he thought would be harder, right? So the first stage, you know, he says we more, you know, more widespread voting rights, you know, the ability to, you know, eat at the same lunch counter. These are really central to thinking about how to relate to your citizens in free and equal, as I would say. Right. But they're in a way got on the cheap, right? They didn't require too many people to sacrifice resources to get there. In fact, they might, if you're more wise about how economies work, they actually probably help. Societies that integrate tend to do better economically, right? So it's fact, and broadly speaking, in people's economic interest, in fact, to go with some of these civil rights things. But that's not necessarily the case with respect to this sort of second stage, right? So King's political economy then is largely this idea that because African Americans are, for a wide range of historical reasons, disproportionately among the relatively unskilled, less educated workers, and because of changes in the economy, he's, like Mead, concerned that that technological change will not produce inclusive prosperity, but instead will replace labor and not reinstate them. I'm importing some language onto King there, but that's broadly the concern. That organized labor and labor movements and people concerned with racial justice, the ends of the civil rights movement, these people have to get together, in part because neither of them independently is going to be powerful enough to bring about the kind of change that he thinks is necessary. Right. So the end of the civil rights movement is not just a fair race society where race doesn't matter with respect to equal opportunity. It's a society where broadly speaking, work in the dignity of workers, regardless of race, is well respected and is well recognized. And then he proposes a number of reforms, some of which look like some of the reforms I propose in Chapter 7. But that's his conception of the ends. And one of the brilliant things about King's public philosophy here is that his normativity here, his conception of the ends of civil rights movement, you know, correlates with the sort of the politics that would be necessary in order to make those ends realizable. Right. So there's a really nice internal link between his conception of economic justice and the politics necessary. Now, of course, that politics didn't develop in a way when he was writing, in the late 60s, that might have been like the ultimate of the getting together of organized labor in the civil rights movement, rather than just what he hoped, which was just the starting point of working together. So King's work in his writings, his speeches, you know, provide both some of the normative core, but also help me think about what the political reality of a just work society would look like.
And that's also I think that also can lead to a discussion about gender. There's obviously a long history of reflections on matters of economic justice in the feminist tradition. And you return us briefly here to the Jetsons to discuss the division of the gender division of labor.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, so the Jetsons are not our ideal. The world of the Jetsons is a world where, broadly speaking, gains in technological innovation are leading people to broadly shared gains in prosperity. It's also a world where you don't see people of color anywhere, basically. And it's also a world where you have this extremely rigid gender division of labor. Right. So there might be this kind of sense of if someone's like talking about some of the positives of mid-century, 20th century economy, that I might be like, if you really quickly read the book or a synopsis of it or something like that, you might say like, well, he's just clamoring for the good old days. But the good old days were really terrible in a lot of ways, right? With all these hierarchies. And so a central core end of the book and the main subject of Chapter 4 and Chapter 5 on race and on gender is to note that, in fact, these winner-take-all trends are in, if anything, more important to tackle from the perspective of those concerned with racial and gender justice. Now, gender, of course, the nature of it is a phenomenon. It doesn't intersect or overlap with class in the way that race does, right? So the winner-take-all trends have less of an impact on gender. And in fact, at the same time, society's become increasingly winner-take-all has been a time when you've seen, you know, sort of unprecedented gains in women's workforce participation, relative earnings, and so on. So there can be this sort of belief that the problem is really like a white male problem. But of course, women disproportionately make up what Mead calls the low productivity service sector, right? Low wage workers are disproportionately women workers.
Yeah, the folks being hit by COVID right now, right?
In particular,
women and people of color.
Exactly. In particular, one of the underlying themes throughout the entire book is that COVID is exacerbating these winner take all trends. A couple of interesting things have happened since I wrote the book, actually, that have changed that short term. But I'm worried about it's just a short term thing. But anyway, all which is to say, tackling these winner take all trends are particularly important, right? And part of thinking about gender justice in this case then is to think about the sources of gender justice, understood in this case of being one way of understanding it is in terms of the gender wage gap and what's driving it. A lot of what's driving it is these winner take all trends. A lot of the existing gender wage gap is more pronounced in occupations that have a certain set of characteristics. I talk about Claudia Goldman's work here, and all sorts of reasons why that's an issue. But a lot of it centers around what might sometimes be called talked about in terms of the marriage penalty, right? So right, you get this, and if I use the term marriage, when I've used the term marriage penalty in engagements where there are conservatives involved, they'd be like, "Are you saying being a mom is not a worthwhile activity or whatever?" And of course, I don't mean anything like that. And in fact, my political philosophy looks a lot like a philosophy of care in terms of what I propose, interestingly enough. But in any event, a lot of the inequality that exists is really inequality between married women and men with women of children, right? So unmarried women make 96% of the wages of unmarried men. In most large urban areas, unmarried women make more than unmarried men. There's lots of complications there in terms of how people select their spouses and selection bias and that sort of data and all sorts of things like that. But you get this huge, and Goldman talks about this, you get this huge growing inequality that happens once people get married and have children, right? This the lingering effects of our gender division of labor, right? So if we're going to address that issue and do so in a way that doesn't trade off with other concerns, right? So, gender justice policy that doesn't generate other sorts of inequalities. Lots of policies that are meant to address gender justice will actually end up trading off with other versions of equality. But one sort of central proposal, just as a way of kind of summing up the work I do in that chapter, that I make at the end is publicly funded childcare, right? So my central proposal at the end of chapter 5, and indeed one of my central policy proposals for the idea of just work in general, is publicly provided childcare. This plays a kind of, and if it's okay, Tom, I'll talk a little bit about how it fits these things fit together. But it's particularly well suited to addressing gender inequality in the workplace, right? Publicly provided childcare, what does it do? Well, the childcare workers are disproportionately women, right? They're disproportionately poorly paid women. Any policy that raises demand for and wages of childcare workers and early childhood educators is going to disproportionately benefit women. It's going to narrow the gender wage gap, right? It's going to, if you will, cross-redress these policies, right? The availability of publicly provided childcare and high-quality childcare will also mitigate many of the sort of inequalities that arise from the so-called marriage penalty, right? right? To make this accessible, you will prevent, if nothing else, another choice to people. But it also, publicly provided childcare is not just about gender justice or anything like it, right? There's all sorts of, again, and of course, you always have to ask, any public policy is how well is it put into place, how well is it run and managed, whatever. But there's all sorts of evidence that points to positive gains for children for the availability of the availability of early childhood education, and also that we disproportionately underinvest in early childhood education, right? The people who most benefit from it are kids who don't have any money, right? And the people whose parents are usually younger and have less resources to invest in early childhood education, even if they wanted to, right? And they're not able to borrow to do it, right? It's not like I can borrow like a student loan and I'm better off after having to go to school. I can't do that with my kids, right? So there's all sorts of reasons to believe that as a society, by leaving it, as it were, to the market, we chronically underinvest in these things. But also early childhood education and daycare for children, free, quality, available to all, right? If it pays well enough, it creates all sorts of middle-class employment for those who are otherwise scraping by, right? It creates, on my pandemic ethics podcast, Candice Diehl-Bartel, an early childhood educator. And we talked about the challenges of providing childcare during the pandemic. But one of the challenges is staffing and getting people to see that providing early childhood education is not just like what you do before you get a real job, as some say, right?
Yes.
But rather to give it a middle-class employment, right?
Yes.
But also the availability of childcare, one of the major challenges in a winner-take-all economy is this geographical polarization. Right. That is, you have some high productivity, relatively high opportunity parts of the United States, and you get lots of islands who are kind of like small islands separated from much of the rest. Right. Or just in general, the ability to move to job, the ideal society for no one is a society where people always have to leave their community to get a good job. Right. But nonetheless, the availability of early childhood education and daycare makes it much easier for people to relocate in search of employment, right? Because in order to relocate, you lose access to maybe at least temporarily some friends or family that might have otherwise provided part of this care. It makes it much easier to search for better work, and it makes it easier to stay in work and get the next promotion to continue to develop your career. So there's this. This is why. I've been sort of really cheering on the sort of, the second infrastructure policy and really hoping it become a reality. It's central to the Just Work blueprint, as it were, is this particular policy. But as you see, it disproportionately, or more generally, though, speaking, African-American women face no marriage penalty, right? In part because so many African-American men are in prison, right? Right. So a central way, I guess this is one way of putting Chapter 4 and Chapter 5 together. But also for these people, the gender wage, the fact that there's this tremendous inequality in the top of finance between men and women, someone could see that as an injustice. I see it as injustice, but it matters less than bring about more broad gains to economic growth, because women, again, and women of color in particular, are disproportionately represented in lower wage work. Anything that elevates that work, that brings about a more inclusive sharing of the fruits of economic growth, is going to be central to Just Work feminism.
So let's talk a little bit, because we have just a few minutes left here, about some of your ideas for reforms, some of the recommendations you make at the end of the book for bringing about Just Work for All.
Good. So I have a list of things, and one of the central concerns when coming up with this list of reforms is I'm not presenting a picture of an ideally just society. Each of these individual reform proposals offers the opportunity to make American society comparatively just in the status quo that doesn't depend on adopting them all at the same time, right? So in a way, someone might think of it as a kind of a piecemeal approach, but really what I think this is just consistent with the way the practice and politics of justice works, which is you take a set of principles and concerns that people have, including the dignity of work, just work, and you advocate for concrete changes in these different ways. And so I talk about Right, exactly. Right. Not, you know, because it's bringing us closer to the ideal per se, but because it's comparatively just in a society where we didn't adopt these reforms. Okay. So, exactly. And what's good about that from a politics is that you don't, sometimes trying to get perfect can actually take you further from better. But anyway, I talk about that in the book. We don't need to talk about that here. I'm going to kind of laundry list some of them, some of the things I talk about. But the main reform, I talk about at least 8 different sorts of reforms. One is public child care and early childhood education. Tax reform, the evolution of American tax code is a moral disaster. Is society has become increasingly winner take all. We've used our tax code to throw gasoline on the fire of these winner take all trends. And magnify their impact, and in fact, in some cases, drive their impact through our reforms of the tax code. Reforms to collective bargaining, ways, there's all sorts of interesting work being done by political scientists, sociologists, people across disciplines, economists, on how to lower the costs of collective bargaining and how to strengthen, how to make it easier for workers in general to have more say and more power. So I talk about reforms to that, including reforms to corporate governance, industrial policy, right? There should be a sort of a, you know, I argue for a variety of technological change is not justice neutral, right? There are much more labor friendly or labor unfriendly forms of technological change. Much of the part of what makes American society increasingly winner take all is a lot of the biggest sort of like shakers, movers and shakers in industry. A lot of the sort of the largest growing segments of the economy don't really require much by way of workers. You know, this transition from a manufacturing economy to an intangibles economy for all sorts of reasons I talk about in the text. Raises particular challenges, but even with respect to innovation and automation, and again, I cite, you know, works by Drone Simoglu and others. You know, there are more labor-friendly change. One thing I talk about in the book, but I kind of want to underline, and it's one of the things I'll talk more about in one of the many projects I'm working on right now, is the role of federal jobs guarantee might play. You know, one of the things I didn't see coming. Necessarily when I was writing last spring 2020, is this rising wages and rising bargaining power of workers to a certain extent. That is, I didn't see this, and it may just be a short-lived phenomenon where either because of the pandemic, either people are rethinking work and their priorities, or because, you know, government's done something particularly in the last several months, that it hasn't done much in my lifetime, which is it adopted policy that strengthened the bargaining power of workers by extending unemployment insurance and making it more robust, right, among other things. Lots of people don't like that. They want workers to be comparatively desperate and powerless. But one of the ways,
and the effects are pretty spotty.
Right, exactly. But nonetheless, you are still seeing some wages increase in certain segments. Federal jobs guarantee can do something like that in spades. It can tackle sort of two sort of different sections of just work. It tackles both the, you know, by tightening the labor market, increasing the bargaining power of workers, it tends to bring about a more equal sharing of the fruits of economic growth, but it also mitigates domination and hierarchy in the workplace, right? If one has good quality opportunities outside of their current job, then they are less subject to, you know, as a relational egalitarian or a neo-Republican political philosopher would say, they're less subject to the domination or arbitrary power of their workers, right? So a jobs guarantee is something I talk about in the book, but I might have underlined is pretty close to a first best way to further just work. In the status quo. I also talk about infrastructure. You know, a big part of the decline to just work is rooted in failing to, you know, provide infrastructure jobs and then to keep our infrastructure up to date. But also another one is just the rapidly rising cost of healthcare, which functions as a kind of wage suck throughout much of the economy. And, you know, there's a, you know, all all of my work in theory and practice of justice is sensitive to path dependence, and path dependence makes healthcare reform challenging. But you know, anything that can work to separate this link between employment and access to healthcare, and do so in a way that not just that doesn't just leave millions of people without healthcare at all, would be a big step forward for Just Work, recognizing that Just Work is not just concerned with wages, it's also concerned with security. And in fact, in many cases, American public philosophy, Americans are more concerned with having a fair amount of healthcare in particular, but also just with security, with being able to make the basic needs of their family, than they are with their ability to rise to the top through their own efforts, right? So a public philosophy that best captures Americans' deeply held convictions, but also a public philosophy that's better suited to a winner-take-all economy is one that secures these basic needs for everyone, who's willing to work for them. Anything we can do to make these parts of a middle-class existence not depend upon the sorts of employment the sorts of jobs that are fewer and further between in a winner-take-all economy is likely to further Just Work.
Very good. Well, Joshua Price, thank you so much for your time today. Once again, the book is Just Work for All, The American Dream in the 21st Century, out on Routledge. It's a terrific book if you have a chance. And my name is Tom DeSena, and this has been the New Books Network.